say that this is an interview with Merle Curti on specifically on the history department, and I'm Laura Smale. The date I think is January 23rd, and we're having this interview in the in a room of the University Club. And you were saying that the rating, that at one time it was rated third, but you weren't sure how much in fact that meant.
These are judgments made by other historians, and I'm not sure how comprehensive or selective the people questioned are. I'm sure that information is available somewhere, but I've never heard just how it is assembled. And then, of course, personal judgments are often influenced by personal considerations. For example, where one did one's own graduate work and the extent that he knows the people in that department may either incline him favorably or unfavorably toward people in the department or toward the department. But I think these ratings do mean something. I don't want to suggest that I think they're of no value. I think they do. They do have some significance.
Well, I have, one might say, three categories of questions. One has to do with the years up to the early 60s. And I know you retired in 67.
68.
Oh, good. Well, that gives you another year in the 60s. And then the period in the 60s, and then your own teaching and the way you handled graduate students and that sort of thing. And we did talk at lunch and talked about some things. One of the, I mean, Naplan stands out. He was chairman all that time. And you, in your earlier interview, said that you didn't always agree with him and that but that he was a fine speaker and that sort of thing. Do you have anything to say? You said you had seen a letter that you'd written to your wife about Naplan.
Well, I don't remember that.
Or something recently that reminded you that...
Oh. Well, as I've been thinking about this, I do want to put on the record that Mr. Naplan was a man of extremely strong opinions. And he found it very difficult, I think, to make any concessions in his view that jeopardized very much things as they were. As he was hesitant about innovations which he thought might not be expedient or that might, in his thinking, lower the standards of the department. For example, shortly after World War II, there began, in a way I don't need to specify here because it's been written up and documented in the American Quarterly. It was launched the American Studies Association, and I had a small part, at least, in the formation of this organization. And at Minnesota, at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and many other universities, American Studies programs were begun. And I wanted to do something of the sort here that was being so successfully done at Minnesota.
This would be interdisciplinary.
Yes,
an
interdisciplinary, a new PhD program in American Studies. This would involve, on the part of candidates for the PhD, taking fewer courses in, much less work in, European history, because they would have to work up some knowledge of American philosophy, American political theory and science, and structure and so on, and American sociology, and certainly American literature. So this would mean that the requirements for the PhD, which I've stressed the importance of European history as as a necessary part of American history. Would Mr. Napkin's view greatly weaken the scholarship in the American history field?
All right.
I could understand this point of view because I myself had taken a strong stand in favor of European intellectual history from the Middle Ages and the modern period as indispensable for students of American intellectual history. And another factor entered into our failure to develop a really strong program in American civilization, American studies, and that was that Professor Pachman was not really interested in it. He was the person in American literature, in addition to Professor Harry Hayden Clark. Mr. Clark was interested and cooperative, but he had his hands full with an incredible number of PhD candidates. I don't know how he ever handled them, but it must have been overwhelming. And many of my students took a minor in the English department in American literature. So the fact that we didn't have strong support really from the American literature group was another factor in explaining why, in spite of my own interest in American studies, we didn't really develop much of a program. Mr. Naplin did relent enough to enable us to work out a program, and it was in the catalog. And a few students elected this. But the disadvantages in finding jobs also figured into my own failure to push the program as strong as I should. Mr. Naplin made a great point of that. He said, mm-hmm. How are you going to find jobs for these people? So this is an example of Mr. Naplin's strong opposition to a suggested innovation.
Who else in the American history?
Well, I was really the only one in favor of it.
Oh, I see. Who else was there at the time?
Well, Mr. Heseltine was, in general, opposed to it, and no one was really much in favor of it.
I see.
America.
So it really was your.
So it was really something that I felt Wisconsin ought to take some position on and develop a program, but we didn't. And Mr. Naplin was really only one factor in our failure. Mm-hmm. So that today there are very strong programs in many institutions, and we're one of the exceptions in mm-hmm. really having none.
Did it make you angry that you couldn't get this through?
He finally consented. He finally gave his verbal consent.
For what reason? Why do you think?
Because I just insisted that we couldn't turn our backs against this. That there was probably a great deal in its future, and there has been. It's a very flourishing field.
Yeah.
The American Studies Association is now one of the strongest associations we have.
Did you threaten to leave? Was that the way would you have threatened to leave? Would that be a way?
No, but he knew that I had chances to leave, and he didn't want completely to stymie it, but he dragged his feet. However, he did finally concede.
Yeah.
Well, he said, go ahead and try it, and I won't object. And
we
got it into the catalog. But then we found that for whatever reason, not many candidates wanted to take this. Mm-hmm. I had a few.
Well, it would take time for that.
It would take time to get started. And so just gradually disappeared.
Yeah. So he could say, I told you so.
Yeah, so he could say, I told you. But this would be one example, I think, where he did oppose something, but finally agreed to give his nominal consent. And this indicates that he was a person of great influence in the department.
Yes. Did you have any allies in European history?
I think George Mosse.
George Mosse was there already.
Yeah, George Mosse was. Well, no, I guess it wouldn't have been George Mosse. It would have been probably Paul Farmer.
Hmm.
I'm not quite sure. But there was no overwhelming enthusiasm in the department, and you can see why, because the department really didn't want any rival, and an American Studies program might lead to an American Studies department. Mm-hmm. though I didn't think that was necessary. I thought we could still maintain the English American literature in the English department, American history in the history department. And I didn't think that a new department was necessary. Though some universities started a new department, but I thought we could do it without. Well, this is only not an important thing.
Well, it explains, in your earlier interview, you spoke of his opposition to interdisciplinary studies, and this is what you were talking about.
Yes, this is what I had in mind.
Yeah, I see.
This is what I had in mind. I think he also was, he made some very good suggestions which the department didn't take up. One of his suggestions, he never pushed it, but he threw it out, that I think Wisconsin is a logical department to develop immigration studies. But no one really responded to this. And Minnesota and other institutions have done this.
Mm.
But he did think that this was a logical thing in terms of the number of immigrants in this state and the materials that would be available.
If he had so much influence, why didn't he do something about
well,
it?
Well, this is, again, he just suggested when a new appointment came, perhaps this is the time when you might look for somebody in immigration history. He never went beyond that.
He
just threw it out.
It
was a good idea, really. Mm. It would have been. We couldn't do everything, but that was a logical thing, and it illustrates that while he was interested in some new developments, I mention it only because I don't want to give the impression that he was opposed to everything new. He thought this would be something. It was a new field. Very little had been
something
done.
Something he was very familiar with.
And something he was familiar with.
Yes. But I still don't understand, since he seems to have had so much authority in regard to appointments, why he couldn't have himself found somebody and then said...
I don't think he would do that. No, I think he had the feeling that those in the American field must be the ones to select people. I don't think he ever tried to tell us that we... I've forgotten the situation in regard to Louis Gottschalk.
Well, I was going to... That was my next question.
That.
Well,
I don't know. I don't think he was chairman then.
I understood he was. Somebody else has spoken about that, and that he refused to hire him because he was Jewish.
I'd have to check on who was chairman.
Well,
but the thing is, there was opposition in the department. He wasn't the only one who was anti-Semitic. There were others.
Yeah.
However, in spite of this feeling, the department did vote to invite Louis Gottschalk to come after we had sounded him out and asked him whether he would consider an invitation, and he admitted that he might. There was enough support for it, so that it got to, I think it got to the president's office. And I think Dr. Fred vetoed it. Now, the problem is, why would Fred veto it? Had Mr. Naplan or someone used their influence on Mr. Fred, but it doesn't seem likely to me that Dr. Fred himself would have said no. The excuse that was given to us was that Gottschalk was really too old.
Yeah.
I've forgotten how old he was, but that he was too old. This was the... And so I think it did get up to the president's office, and it's quite possible. I think Mr. Naplan had a way of... speaking to Dean Ingram or to the president on departmental matters, if he was opposed to something and it had gone through the department. Now, this is a conjecture. I have no evidence for this.
Yes.
I have no evidence for it. But it seems to me a little unlikely that Mr. Fred, who, so far as I know, had never on any other occasion taken any position other than the nominal approval which the dean and the president always give to a major new appointment.
Mm.
So far as I know, he never showed any particular interest one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
One might have expected that he would, for instance, have been interested in the strong development of agricultural history, but I think he was very glad that Vernon Carstensen was teaching something like it, but I don't think he... it wasn't in his character to play any active role in the history department, except in a general way to approve of any honors or distinctions that anyone in the department got.
I guess see. Oh, this is, I talked to George Mossy. We just talked, yeah. And I typed down what he said, and he said a great deal. But later when I talked to Mort Rothstein about, I guess George Mossy was hired under Fred Harrington, when Fred Harrington was chairman. And Mort said what George didn't know was that Naplan had fiercely objected to his appointment, to George's appointment, because he was Jewish, and that that had been a major breakthrough, getting a Jew onto the history faculty. The department had had an opportunity in the 1940s to get Louis Gottschalk, but wouldn't take him because he was Jewish. Now that's
I'm not sure that this was the 1940s. It could have been later.
Well, the Gottschalk appointment was the 40s.
It was?
I believe so.
I can't remember. I'm very poor remembering right now dates. I would have thought it was somewhat later. And I thought Naplan was not chairman then, but maybe he was.
While Gottschalk was being considered. No,
I don't know who was chairman. I thought it came later then. I thought it came in Saxis or some other.
Oh, I see. Well, that's...
So I would... I'm not sure. I don't know how to find out.
As a proper historian, you'd have to say you don't know. Okay.
I don't know. But my impression is that the Gottschalk thing came up considerably later.
So this may be something that, somebody could easily look into that.
Somebody would need to look into it because it's the question of who was chairman then. In the case of, we considered George Mossy on an earlier occasion, and for whatever reason, the department, and I can't remember what, I may not have even been here, but I did insist that from the very beginning that we had to have somebody in European intellectual history, that I couldn't properly train people in American intellectual history unless they had a chance to study European intellectual history. And it was on that basis that we got Paul Farmer. I don't think otherwise the department would have moved in that direction, but I said we had to have someone.
Yeah.
And after Paul Farmer left, I think we considered at one point Felix Gilbert, who was a very distinguished refugee from Vienna, and is at the Institute of Advanced Studies, and very distinguished indeed. And he came out for an interview. He was of course Jewish, and no offer was made to him, but I think there, even I, who was in favor of it because of his distinction, had reservations because it didn't seem in talking with him that he would ever be a very effective lecturer for at least undergraduate students. So I don't know whether anti-Semitism came in there. I don't really think it did.
I can.
And I don't know how deep this anti-Semitism was. Mr. Eason shared it to some extent. And verbally, Bill Heseltine did. But Bill Heseltine often said things that, to annoy somebody else, particularly to annoy those he either didn't like or whose views he thought were, liberal views. He posed as a great conservative. Actually, he wasn't. He'd been a socialist and a pacifist himself. And I'm not sure how deep his feeling about Jews was, but certainly Mr. Naplan, on one occasion, I think it was very early in my period here, I was walking with some student who seemed to have the appearance of being Jewish. I'm very careful about that because who can say? And we were working along Bascom Hall, and the student left, and Mr. Naplan said, I thought rather gratuitously, well, he said, IRC, you have New York Jewish friends, or something like this. Mm-hmm. But there was no particular occasion for it. I don't think at one time he did have this. I have the feeling that in his later years he greatly modified his views about ethnic groups.
What George Mossy says about his appointment is that that Eason, Higby, and Petrovich were there in modern history, and Reynolds and Post in medieval history. He said Jensen and Curdy invited him, Mossy.
Well, we were very anxious to get him.
I
knew he was a brilliant lecturer, but his reputation at Iowa.
Yeah. And he said it was the Americanists who put through his appointment. Against the Europeans, I guess.
I think it was.
Yeah.
But to what I think that was true.
Yeah. Somebody said that Heseltine. You told me that. He said it differently. Is that right?
He was a great joker, and it's very hard to make him out. And he was essentially, he had a deep down a very warm heart, and he had the admiration and affection of many of his students, and not of all. But he was a very complex person, and he was a tremendous teaser. He just loved to say provocative things, would get under anyone's skin. Mm-hmm. And it was always very difficult to know how serious he was in things that he said. As, for example, giving a whole long paper at a meeting of the Mississippi Valley Historical Association denouncing intellectual history. Yet I can't think that he thought it was all that bad.
And you said he used the term ineffectual history.
Yes. I think that he liked to be in the opposition. At the time of the McCarthyite period, he posed to be in favor of McCarthy because of all of these communists. Well, most of us were liberals and very much against McCarthy. And I'm sure that he wasn't for McCarthy, but this was his way of poking fun at the so-called liberals and at us in general. But I don't think I think deep down he was as much opposed to McCarthy as anyone. So it was very difficult to make him out.
Well, I've heard two contradictory statements. One is that he was very much in Naplan's shadow and agreed with everything that Naplan said and wanted to follow him. And then somebody else, and I guess it was Al Bogue, or maybe more, said that he was very influential in the department. Now, I don't know know that they enlarged
so
on that.
So he was.
But in what way was he influential?
He had great either respect or perhaps earlier awe, but he had certainly great respect for Naplan. He thought Naplan's judgment was very good. And in general, he tended to agree with Mr. Naplan in general. I think he did.
But do you think he was subservient to him, or
no? Not really that. But he came here when he was young. He came here when he was quite young, and Mr. Naplan was the dominant figure. I think he honestly felt Naplan had good judgment, and he tended, I think, as I remember, to agree with him on things that came up. But I don't know whether that would have been always true, but I think often true.
But then how was Heseltine influential in the department? In appointments or what?
Yes, in appointments.
If you could hold that up. You don't have to hold it up like that, but just facing
Yes, in appointments, I think probably chiefly. What other ways?
Was he a wise man, would you say?
Well, he often had insights and that were interesting and good, but he was so quixotic and whimsical.
Yeah, it sounds to me
that I'm not sure that his influence in the department was as great as some think. I don't think so. I think he talked in a very pontifical way, in a very deep, low, rounded voice, and gave the impression of carrying a very great deal of weight. But I'm not sure that this is always true. I remember when I first came and had several invitations the first year after the first year I was invited to Cornell and to a very good new professor at Northwestern. And I asked Bill Heseltine, how he felt about it. I thought that would give him a chance to, if he really wanted to get rid of me, that it would give him a chance to say, I think you ought to go. Mm. But he never did. He was always expressed some appreciation and never in any way encouraged me to leave, which he might.
Why would he have wanted to get rid of you?
Well, because he really didn't completely approve of intellectual history. No, he thought he didn't really take a high view of it. He thought it was flimsy and not very not in the mainstream of American history.
He sounds very old-fashioned. Mm-hmm.
For him, everything centered really, he believed in constitutional history, which was good, but everything centered in the Civil War, mm-hmm. things leading up to it and things coming out of it. And that's a position that many good historians have taken, and one that is quite defensible, but mm-hmm. he was very much committed
well,
to
that.
Well,
that doesn't eliminate intellectual history.
But this
history.
Doesn't really eliminate it, no.
So he sounds like a very conservative, old-fashioned
yes.
historian.
In
and
many
Malcolm
ways.
Too, obviously.
In many ways, yes.
So,
well, Mr. Naplin, I think, was very much of a traditionalist in his views of history. He did emphasize, to some extent, he recognized, I'm sure, social and economic factors, but I think his main emphasis was political and constitutional, mm-hmm. and that was what people were doing in the days that he came up. That was the
but
way.
But it was already
yes.
in the backwash, was, really,
yes.
wasn't it?
Well, people were already beginning to do things in a different way. I think he was very, very disappointed that... I know he was terribly disappointed when, after his retirement, the department didn't appoint one of his own students to be a successor who would carry on the teaching of the British Empire pretty much as he had taught it. For one reason, there was no... we felt there was no really extremely strong candidate who had mm-hmm. been one of his students. And so until Curtin came and made it very clear from the beginning that this was not the way he was going to do it, I think Mr. Naplin was very disappointed that he thought, you know, his work in building up this as a field for which Wisconsin did have some distinction was now being washed down the drain.
He must have been, well, let's
but he didn't say
he must have been very opposed to Curtin. And to Curtin's coming, who got
well,
Curtin?
But I'm not sure whether he... see, my dates, I can't remember exactly. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so. I think... I really don't know. I just can't remember well enough. But I can't remember that anyone opposed Phil Curtin's coming, but I know that after he... indicated at a dinner here at the faculty club shortly after came his conception, which was to emphasize the development of the African countries and comparative tropical history generally, that Mr. Naplin was very disappointed. But I think by that time he had retired. I think he had retired.
He retired in 55, I think.
In 55, and I don't know when Phil Curtin came.
I ought to have gotten that done. Well, I'd like to ask you, one question. Somebody said that there was quite a rivalry between you and Howard Beale.
Oh, well, Howard Beale. I had a letter just yesterday from Paul Gates at Cornell, a very able historian who, Bogue was one of his students, and so was
Mort Rothstein. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Paul Gates said, you must write some kind of a memoir.
Excuse
because.
Me, Merle.
Yes.
Paul
Gates said, "You write your memoirs because you're the only person who could assess properly Howard Beale." Well, I that may be true because not so many people are living now who knew Howard as long as I did. I knew him from graduate school days on, and I had a great respect for his intellectual ability and for his scholarship. And in general, we very strongly agreed on things which were really minority positions in the country at large. We were very strong against discrimination against the blacks. We were both very strong believers in racial equality insofar as it could be achieved. We were both very strong civil liberties people. Mm-hmm. So that we shared some of the same commitments. And Howard was... and also to an extent pacifism. Only Howard was more consistent and courageous, I think, perhaps, than I. Yet that isn't quite fair to myself. In World War II, he couldn't support the war, but what he did do was very helpful. In fact, it was, I think, very important. He volunteered with the Friends Service Committee and helped relocate the Japanese in their prison camps that they had been sent to. This was an extremely useful thing to do, and I think he did it very well. On Pacifin, we were both essentially pacifists. In the case of World War II, I thought, well, this maybe is the one war I have to make an exception to. When I realized what was happening to the Jews and to other peoples under the Nazi regime, I thought there's probably no other way to stop Hitler. And reluctantly, my wife and I, she was a very strong fan, we said, well, we can only support this war. Whereas Howard was really very consistent. He said, I am a pacifist and I won't approve of the war, but I will help these Japanese. Mm-hmm. So there were many things that I greatly admired and respected, and he had courage and guts and consistency. On the other hand, he was highly moral in his judgments, and if you disagreed with him, you were not only betraying the ideal and him, but you were showing your inadequacies of character. And he was extremely morally righteous, and as his mother was. And this made it very difficult when one didn't agree with him on any question. He theoretically was a great believer in toleration, but this was limited when people took positions that he thought were morally wrong or intellectually inexpedient. He had got along very badly at Chapel Hill. I knew the whole story. His colleagues there disliked him, wanted to get rid of him, couldn't.
And was he personally antagonized?
Yes, he was very anti alcohol. He disapproved of any alcoholic drinks. People socially at Chapel Hill, as elsewhere, did serve drinks. He was very much against that. And it is true there were many there who were very unsympathetic with the blacks, who really took the old-fashioned Southern white view. So he was in a very uncomfortable position. But he, on the other hand, didn't handle himself with even moderate tact. He made his opinions very clear, and they were. So in 1944, I think it was, at a breakfast at Merrill Jensen's, where Harrington and Hillstein and I were there, we had to decide on a new person. And Howard's name came up, and he was a very strong scholar. He was intellectually, he'd already established a reputation. He was working on is Theodore Roosevelt. And I remember definitely saying, he will be very hard to get along with. I know him very well. I think I can get along with him, and I certainly won't oppose his coming, but I want to warn all of you that he will be a difficult colleague. Mm. And Merrill said, well, I can get along with him. And
did Merrill know him?
I don't think he knew him very much. But, well, probably slightly. Mm. And so Bill said, well, I get along with anybody. I get along with everybody.
And Harrington?
And Harrington. So it was agreed to invite him to come. He did step on toes and antagonize a great many people in the department. And it was partly because of his unwillingness to see points of view other than his own. And his inability to rid himself of this aroma of moral superiority. My chief conflict, I disagreed with him on many things, but we got along pretty well until the question of the question came up of what should be done in the Mississippi Valley Association, about to become the Organization of American Historians, place of meeting. I had been elected president, and Howard approved of that. He was, I'm sure, very pleased that I was, and I'm sure he would have liked to have been himself, and in time might have been. But the association could not meet in a southern city, though we like to think of ourselves as a national organization, because in a southern city at that time there was no hotel which would admit black members. And Nevertheless, most of the people in the executive committee of the association wanted to meet in New Orleans. It's a charming place and interesting, and many people wanted to go there. And I said, I cannot give a presidential address in any hotel in New Orleans or anywhere else if members of this association, who happen to be black, cannot sit at the tables with the rest of us. And I made myself immensely unpopular.
Now, where were you? You were doing this with
the
executive board.
Yeah, I was
of
president, and this was
but
the
I mean,
executive committee.
This must have been at a meeting, or was it in course?
Yeah, so we had several meetings.
Yeah,
you
okay.
Know. And I I made myself extremely disliked because everybody wanted to go to New Orleans. Mm. Now, Howard Beale thought that I didn't go nearly far enough. He said that I should have either resigned the presidency because of this feeling that we ought to go to New Orleans, or what other, I don't know. He set up impossible things mm. that he thought I should do. And it would have, they were utterly impossible. I couldn't do them. I took the position that was an honest and conscientious. Well, he denounced me. He wrote a terrible letter. It was just a letter of complete denunciation.
And to, I think
to me.
Oh, to you.
Yes.
Mm.
For not doing more than simply refusing to give a speech. I should have resigned. I should have done some dramatic thing. And I think I replied in equally mean terms. So I think I just said, well, I've had enough from Howard. And he told me later that he had the letter that I wrote to him. I don't know. I didn't keep any copy. It was so terrible. He said, I've taken it out of my files. I don't want anyone ever to read what you wrote. And I said, well, I must have felt that way, Howard, if I wrote it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that I threw away the letter that he wrote to me. It was really shocking. So he was very difficult to get along with, but
Well, what finally happened there? Did you
what
meet?
Finally happened? How we had to meet in Chicago, and the Chicago nobody at the University of Chicago. You see, there has to be a local arrangements committee.
Mm.
No one in Chicago wanted to serve on a local arrangements committee for a meeting in Chicago. The American historians at the University of Chicago refused to have anything to do with it. Walter Johnson said, "I won't do it." He said, "We don't want it in Chicago."
And what year was this? Do you remember approximately?
1953, I think. I think it was 53. 52, possibly.
Mm.
And nobody at Northwestern would do anything.
Yeah.
And finally, in desperation, I mean, we had to meet someplace. And it had to be a place where there were fairly good-sized hotels. The director of the Chicago Historical Society, I've forgotten his name, I knew the I shouldn't, because he finally said, okay, I will be the chairman, and I will get enough people to serve on this, and we will get a hotel, and blacks can sit there, and we will carry this through. And he did. I think it was I can't remember.
Mm.
But in any case, we did meet there, and Howard did go to the meeting. He had said he wouldn't.
Did he make you late for the plane? Or train somebody, apparently somebody, he at some point.
I can't remember that. But I think he did. I think he went to the meeting. I don't remember that. I think he did. But on the other hand, he was very, and I wasn't always firm enough with him. Sometimes I was. For example, when I was president of the American Historical Association, this was a meeting in New York, and he decided that he wanted to have a big party for me, with all of my friends and his friends and so on. And I said, well, Howard, you know, if you have a party of this kind at the Harvard Club, these people will expect drinks. And I said, you won't. Well, he said, I will make a compromise and I will let those who want drinks have them. But then he wanted it right after the presidential address, when I really wanted to be with my family. My wife and daughters were there. And I said, well, this is the only night it can be. So I foolishly went along with him, and it greatly hurt my wife's feelings, because she would have liked to have had a few of the friends we had in common just in our, we had a suite.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very sorry afterwards that I let Howard do this, but he was so dominant, and it was extremely difficult to oppose. So he, I think, stepped on many, many toes, not only in the department, but he antagonized Dean Ingram to such an extent that Dean Ingram, who's a very, very broad-minded in most things, refused to go to the memorial service. He said he couldn't, in conscience, go to the memorial service.
Would it be personal?
Well, he denounced Dean Ingram apparently more than once, and
for
whatever it was, I don't know the details, but he did. And I know Mark told me, he said, in conscience, I could not go. And I was put in a very difficult situation. Georgia Beale decided to have this memorial service on Lincoln's birthday as an honor to Howard, and to have me speak. And I simply knew too much about Howard to give any kind of a eulogy. I could speak of his integrity and his moral, but I decided that I wouldn't do that. It was canceled out by so many other things. So I said, well, Georgia, I will speak on Howard's contribution to American historical scholarship. And others can speak about other things.
Yeah.
And so I did. I spoke about his contributions, his books, and what they contributed. And why?
And they did contribute something. You still say?
Oh yes, He was a good historian. In spite of all of his emotional bias, he really was a good historian. That's amazing.
George Mossy said you gave the funeral oration without ever mentioning his name. The old
name. Well,
I had a rather wicked sense of humor.
It wasn't. It was just a discussion of his books, and I must have started out by saying, well, let's take a look at the books that Howard wrote. But I didn't, beyond that, I said nothing about any personal things. I just decided that there was a minister there and there were others they were talking about and they could do it.
Yeah. But did you regret bringing him here?
Well, it would have been much easier for me if I hadn't. And I think
of the department, how long was he here?
Well, he had some good students who were quite devoted to him. Yes, some good students. And he always was very jealous. He felt that I had more good students than he did. Well, that wasn't true. I had some awfully poor students and weren't good at all. I had a few good, very good ones. Mm. Not everyone, you know, was really first rate who came to us. And he always said, well, the most interesting students always work with you and they don't come to me. And I said, oh, Howard, you've had some good students. And he did have some good ones.
But that's the point, is that the students choose the professor, don't they?
Yeah.
So.
Well, I don't know. This was a hard question to answer. I think I've often, in the time of student troubles, he, to a great extent, would have been on the student side.
Oh, that's the kind, I see.
He would have been on the student side.
He's sort of a Bill Williams? I mean, personally.
Not like him personally, but somewhat against the powers that
Goldberg.
Be. Somewhat against the powers that be. He was
Was he the sort of perpetual student rebel type? I mean, there are people who go on being like that all their lives, a perpetual rebel.
He always put it on such a high moral plane. Blacks and civil liberties and so forth. Yeah. You know, I put it on a high moral plane. It was quite different from most people's protests. And this was what I think got under people's skin, because it seemed to be a judgment against them that they didn't have the same high moral standards at Howard. So he alienated many people in the university, not just in the history department, but I'm sure he alienated a great many in the department who found him very difficult to get along with.
Did he have any influence in the department? Did he partake in the department?
Oh, yes. He took a strong position on everything.
Oh.
I can't remember just what, but I'm sure. Yeah. Oh, yes. He wouldn't be anyone to sit back and not take a strong position. You see, David Cronin was one of his students.
Oh, that's interesting.
And he had some good students. He had some good students. Mm. And I think they appreciated him. I think he was a very good teacher. He was a very exciting teacher for undergraduates. He got his ideas somehow or other into whatever it was he was talking about. His freedom of speech, freedom of the civil liberties, racial discrimination?
He wouldn't have been, one wouldn't like rabidity in any position, certainly not the conservative right.
No.
Would he have been a rabid sort of
person?
Oh, yes,
it was completely. It would
in
be
teaching too, do you think?
Oh, yes. He wouldn't hesitate to let his students know that he was opposed. See, he died in 1960, and so he lived through the McCarthyite period, and he was very strong against McCarthy. Mm.
But I mean, would his teaching of history be so completely in terms of his own point of view?
No, I think he really tried to strike some kind of a balance, but it was obvious that his own personal feelings entered into it. They do for all of us to some extent. But I think because of the intensity of his feelings and the moral quality of his feelings may have been more striking and more obvious than in the case of those of us who hold them back a little bit or play them a little bit in a lower key, knowing that they do reflect our own biases and our own... So he was a very complex person.
Is there anybody like him around now that you could even faintly compare him to?
No, there will never be anyone like him at all, I'm sure.
Hmm.
I'm sure he's unique. There will never be anyone like him. And you had to know his background. His very much dominated by his mother. And his first marriage, I knew his first wife. I knew quite well his second wife, who was an historian. They were all historians. And even the present Mrs. Beale had a connection with Wellesley, so that Ed Kirkland, who found him extremely annoying as a summer neighbor in Thetford, Vermont, Kirkland, and who was a visiting professor here with us for a time, said, the trouble with Howard marital affairs is he loved Wellesley, he loved Wellesley, but not wisely. but he was must have been very difficult too. Must have been very difficult with and the fact that the present Mrs. Beale was able to take all of this was a matter of much comment.
Well, now, is this when Paul Gates wrote you this?
Yes, Paul
is this
said.
Is what he meant?
Yes, he said, you're the only one who ever could explain Howard Beale in a way that those of us who knew him knew him to be, but nobody could do it except you. And he said, you must do it. It isn't that important. I mean, we have his books, and while the Reconstruction book has understandably and naturally has been pretty largely replaced by the new revision of scholarship, this happens to us all. I think his, on the other hand, his freedom of his academic freedom, his two books on academic freedom, hold up. I don't think anyone will ever replace those. They were very important books on academic freedom, freedom of teachers as well as.
Yeah.
This was Howard Beale.
That's interesting to know all that. I gather he wasn't here for very long.
Well, he came in 1944,
'44.
I think it was 44.
I see. So, and then he was here till 1960.
And he died in 19. When I was in Tokyo, it was 1959, Christmas of 1959, because I was in Tokyo when I had the cable and sent Mrs. Beale a cable.
So you came back for the funeral?
Oh no, she didn't. They had a traditional religious, I guess, funeral. I wasn't here, but she postponed the memorial service until she wanted it on Lincoln's birthday.
Yeah. All right. Now the next question I would like to ask you has to do with the de-chairmaning of Nathlin. I gather that Nathlin and Harrington I have interviewed Harrington, and we weren't really talking about that, although he says some things about Nathlin, but they were apparently in conflict, and it was under Harrington's leadership that Nathlin was depossessed of his long-standing chairmanship. Do you remember that?
I think probably this is true. I wouldn't be able to spell it out.
Mm.
But Harrington was also a very strong person, and I think that Heseltine liked him and believed in him, as did Jensen, and I did too. And I think that Harrington was the first one to appear who could in any way really rival Naplan as a leader in the department. And so he more or less took over.
Was this, he was much younger, presumably.
Yes. And I don't quite know what Mr. Naplan ever thought about. Mr. Naplan always said, I brought Harrington back. He said he was here once and left. Mm-hmm. And he said, I was the one who brought him back.
And then what did he say?
Then he didn't say any more. Oh. But he indicated that he was the one who was responsible for Harrington's being here. Mm. He said he left to go to Arkansas, and then I brought him back.
Do you think, I guess I should, you really don't know anything about it, but you must have known something about it.
No, I just know that I was very glad, and I think many others were, to have Harrington as chairman. How it came about, I don't know. Hmm. We voted for the chairman, and whether there was lobbying or not, I don't remember. Hmm. But I remember that like many others, I was very glad to have Harrington as chairman. Hmm.
Do you remember how things? Well, of course, he would have been in very much in along your line of thinking.
Right. Oh, yes.
In terms of expanding.
Oh, yes, very much, very much. How it happened, I really don't know. There had been a tradition of alternating of chairmanships. For instance, that used to be John Hicks and then Naplan, and then John Hicks and Naplan. Oh. And then after John Hicks left, there was a change. Easton was chairman for a time. Saxey was chairman. Then later on, Jensen was chairman. But I guess this was all later.
Yes, it was later, I think. Jensen was chairman in the early 60s when we came
out. Yes, that's right. Jensen was chairman in the early 60s.
We came over his dead body, I guess.
Right.
But I know that he didn't want to speak to John for several years.
Who was this?
Jensen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was very much opposed to him, I guess.
I never knew that. See, there are a lot of things I don't know.
John was one of Phil Curtin's
Yes. Oh, yes. And, of course, Merrill disliked Phil Curtin.
Yeah. I guess the other question I'd like to ask you about that early period is, who among the members of the History Department did you look upon as your equal in scholarship or people whom you genuinely respected as scholars? Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a great respect for Gaines Post, though his actual contributions in writing were perhaps more limited than one might have hoped. But he was a very interesting teacher, and he had excellent training, and he gave a very strong course on medieval intellectual history, which I encouraged my students to take. And
how did you know it was a good course?
Well, from what the students reported. Oh. Of course, sometimes he probably emphasized more than others would his own interest in Roman law in the Middle Ages, but I think he gave them good training. I think he was a good teacher, and I liked him. I liked Bob Reynolds. I've had the feeling he was. I heard him give a paper once before I ever came here, at the American Historical Association on the city in the Middle Ages, and I thought it was a superb performance. Mm-hmm. Well, I had a very real respect for Bob. His health was such that he couldn't do much publication. Mm. He did very little. But I had the feeling that had he had more vigorous health, he would have done more publishing. But I think he was very good. Mr. Higbee was a man who I liked personally because of his wit and his sense of humor, his low key. And I felt compassion for his great handicap.
What was that?
Well, he had Parkinson's. I don't know whether it was Parkinson's disease, a terrific shaking constantly, something like palsy. I don't know the name of it. The one thing he did do for his students, he insisted that they really thoroughly know German and French. He had very rigorous standards for his students in European history. I don't think he was a great historian. I think he was respectable, but not great. Mr. Easom was
great historians that I'm.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that there were any of us that were really very great, but certainly Jensen hadn't yet achieved the splendid reputation he later had, but he was I had great respect for what he was doing. I knew his thoroughness as a scholar, and that was good. I had great respect for Moisse because I thought that he was stimulating and brilliant and interesting, and colorful, insofar as I read his books, I thought they were not my field, but good. Mm-hmm. So I had a feeling that the strength was largely and probably on the American side, except for Naplan, who was highly regarded in England and in the Commonwealth for his work. He was, the one person in the non-American field who had an international reputation. I don't think that was true of either Mr. Hubie or Mr. Easton, but Naplan did have. He was well regarded in Canada and Australia, mm-hmm. and he was known in England. So one had to respect his scholarship.
So this is tape two of the interview with Merle Curdy on January 23rd. And I guess I'd like to ask you about Phil Curtin. I don't know, again, how aware you were. There have been, some people have said he was very influential, powerful when he came, and he tended to get his appointments through. I know that he...
Well, my feeling about Phil was that... he knew the field he was working in and the fields he wanted to see developed. And he knew who the scholars in the field were. And in general, I just trusted his judgment. And when he proposed someone submitted letters about him, and these were favorable, I was quite willing to accept Phil's judgment.
Now, at this point, were you yourself getting somewhat detached from, did you think, from affairs? Or
no, I was very interested in what he was doing because I always liked innovation and breaking out in a new way. And as I sensed it, he was really developing something which, at least for us, was very different and I thought very new. And I was convinced of the great importance of the so-called... undeveloped or developing or new countries that hadn't figured in
small
our
history.
Yes, and I was very pleased when he went to India, and when he favored bringing an Indian historian here, which he did, and the development of these other fields. And personally, I was on very pleasant terms with Phil Curtin. I didn't know him. We weren't intimate friends, but we were very pleasant friends. And I felt that he knew what he was doing, and I had confidence that his judgment on the whole was good.
So you must have been rather at odds with some of the people in the American.
Jensen didn't like him. I knew, and I guess others. And why they didn't like him, I never quite understood. Because I never felt his overwhelming personality. I never felt that he was pushing things through in his own way against what others wanted. If he was, must have been impervious to it. I didn't get it.
Wouldn't have talked to Jensen about this, or he
no.
to you?
No, I just knew that there were people in the department that didn't like him. And I always found it a little hard to understand because I found Phil pleasant and agreeable, and I was often invited to their house to meet African visitors and so on. Mm-hmm. And I liked Anne very much, so I never quite understood the opposition. But I gather from what others have told me that he was very difficult. And particularly in his attitude toward Vansina.
Did you know Jan?
Jan, I never really knew. I had a very amusing experience. I practically didn't know them at all. But I was living alone, and I had occasional dinners. I had a caterer who would come and get them. And I invited the Van Zinnes for dinner, and they appeared a week ahead of time, and I had nothing in the house to eat to give to them. I was going out myself, as a matter of fact, and so I could only say, well, it's a week later, you've come a week too early, and I said, I can give you a drink if you'll come in, and they didn't accept that, and they came the next time, and it was very pleasant. I found it at that time very difficult to speak with his wife. I don't speak French, really. I speak a little, and it would be better if I didn't speak any, because I'm sure it's very ungrammatical. And if people speak French fast, I don't understand it at all, and yet they expect that I am understanding it. Mm-hmm. But I found it very... my conversation had to be in English. Mm-hmm. And her English at that time was very difficult. I had pleasant impressions of them. And when I knew what he was doing in developing an anthropological approach, I was very sympathetic, because I believed in interdisciplinary approaches to things. And then I would suppose that in a country like Africa, where the amount of literary records of in our sense was much more limited than in Western countries, that this anthropological approach must be very sound. And I had known personally the man at Northwestern in African studies, forgotten his name. Phil chose him as the one for whom the professorship should be named.
Herskovitz.
I knew Herskovitz slightly. Uh-huh. And so I had I was very glad that there was somebody like Van Zinne here who knew at least one country in Africa very well. I didn't understand much about the conflict between him and Phil until people told me about them.
Yes, but, I don't know anything about it either. I know that they've existed.
They existed.
It interests me that here are people like Jensen and others, you say, who didn't like Phil. Who? You were in the... I know you traveled a good deal and were here and there, but who was your group when you had department meetings? The people that you, whose views you knew and who you sympathized with each other, and then the other, or let's say in the American, among the Americans.
Well, I think when we met separately in the American field, we more often than not came to some kind of a working consensus or a working agreement. I was very much against some things that the group did, and I'm sure I was right. They had the idea that our prestige was such that anyone would be pleased to be invited here to be interviewed, whether we were going to invite them or not. And I said, we ought to be very sure from everything we can find out that the person we're going to invite for an interview is the person that we really want, unless when he or she appears, somebody takes a violent dislike to them, or unless it appears to us that the person is not nearly as good or agreeable as we've been led to believe. So again and again and again, the department was expanding rapidly, and we invited so many people here without being at all certain in advance of whether we really wanted them. There were travel funds available, and I said, you know, this is very bad for our reputation. People don't like to be invited and then have no follow-up. I remember Mary Young. I was very keen to have a woman come in. Mary Young was then at Ohio State, and she was very promising, and we invited her, and I think she would have been a very good appointment had we made. There was no one took her. I was the only one. I can't remember whether Beale was around then or not. But this was one of the things that I felt the American historians made a great mistake in doing. That we had any number of people here on this kind of a situation where we hadn't made up our minds. And I said, you know, you have to. I have been invited to a great many places for interviews, and I never went to a single one where I wasn't given an invitation to come. And I said, I would have felt very let down if I had been, and I think that's only natural. But other than that, I can't remember that that we had too much difficulty in the groups. We might differ over the merits of a candidate for a degree, but not in any very serious way. But so I don't have the impression of strong conflicts in the American history group. I liked all of them.
I didn't mean so much conflict, but clearly here's, I mean, just for instance, Jensen disliked Curtin and disapproved of what he was doing, and you liked him and approved of what he was doing.
But this didn't really make a difference. I was a good friend of Jensen. It didn't really make any difference.
Well, I mean, in the running of Department Affairs, who were the people in the American group who were on your side and I mean, that you would talk about how you were going to invite and what you thought about them? Who would be sympathetic? Or were you the only one?
No, I can't remember. I think that I can't remember that there were any very strong. I think I talked with all of them, and I think I was on reasonably good terms with them. I'm sure that I did many things that they could disapprove of, but in general, I felt my relations were good with them, with all of them. And
you sound very separate. You and them. Instead of
yes,
of
we.
Was it because of being an intellectual history?
Well, that perhaps was one.
That you were the only one in intellectual history. Mm-hmm. So it did set you apart somewhat.
Until Bill Taylor came. And then I liked Bill. Many took a great dislike to him, and I never understood that. Many didn't like him. So I think Jensen and I didn't agree on everything, but we were very good friends, and I can't remember any really very strong conflicts. I was asked by the Rockefeller Foundation if I would be willing to accept the grant of $100,000 for American studies, and with special reference to Wisconsin studies and the region about. And with some hesitation, I decided, well, if something is offered to you, you ought to take it. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that I have the feeling I was extremely poor in administering this fund. I just was no good at it. And finally, I asked Merrill, since he was good, if he would take over the administrative responsibilities of this. They were getting me down, all of these papers to make out and these funds and travel and whatnot. I just found it very boring and was very bad at it. Mm. And Merrill did it in a very nice way. The results of the money I always felt didn't justify the grant. And yet, I guess if you would compare what we did with grants to other institutions, we probably, came out about
this
as well.
This wasn't the philanthropy thing, was it?
No, that was the Ford Foundation. This was an earlier one. And here Jensen took over the administrative thing. He didn't blame me for the snarls. We were friends, and he was very. He let it be known. He let it be known. Well, of course, Merle is no good at this kind of thing. Everybody knows that. Yeah. And I'm rescuing it. Well, that was okay. Yeah. I mean, I didn't object to it. I was very glad to have somebody do it, because it was obvious that I was not doing it very well. And so I was very, very glad. I didn't mind a bit, but he would say, well, of course, we all know Merle can't do anything like this. And I've rescued it. But that was, that was okay. It didn't bother me.
You know, this. I just was noticing that Saxe was chairman from
Yes, Bill was chairman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was a very nice guy, and I felt very badly when he left. That the department really showed no appreciation beyond the barest minimum. And I don't think there were many people who lifted their hands. Frances and I, my second wife, had a dinner for them, and we tried to invite the people we thought they would most like to see. Mm-hmm. These were largely outside of the department. And they were so appreciative that it was just pathetic. You know, it was all, we just had it at the Madison Club. It was not much.
Well, what's the story behind it?
I don't know. People, Bill didn't make warm, Saxey didn't, I think, make warm friends with people. I think he was decent and aloof. I think he was a competent chairman, not vigorous like Harrington. And not domineering like Naplan could be. I don't know. I liked him. He was not, you know, a close friend, but we were on very friendly terms. But I felt very badly at the time that he left. He'd been here a long time, and there's I don't think anything was done in any way to. Indicate that he had been with us for a long time and had.
Well, Donna interviewed him last year.
I was wondering if she had.
And I was just listening to the interview.
How was the interview?
Well, it's extremely general. You know, there's nothing in it that one doesn't know.
Yes.
But some of the attitudes, that's my.
Well, Nancy, now on one occasion, Naplan was very hard on him. I was in a place where I was in a small meeting. I don't know who else was there. Naplan was extremely hard on him for not having done more research, more publication.
Oh.
And I felt very badly about that.
Naplan took on himself to do that.
Yes, he did. Because he said, I brought you here.
Good idea.
You're in English history. You're in my field. And I brought you here expecting you were going to do so and so and thus and publish, and all you've done is some editing.
Did and he ever publish?
Yes, he did. He got out some small, yes, not major things, but he got interested in the American colonies and their relationship to England.
So he wasn't a great scholar.
I don't think so. But a very human and decent person. Not warm and outgoing, but pleasant.
Well, one of the things they covered in this interview was the hiring of women, and he made the comment that you know, women weren't going into history very much at that time, and it was always hard to find them. Well, you know, I went to Smith, and I know that there were fine women historians there.
Yes.
And I'm sure that there were many fine women historians around. And I really didn't like to hear that said. I could imagine it being said that the department wasn't willing to consider any of them, but that there weren't good women historians.
Yes.
I don't know. I just can't believe that.
Well, let's take for a moment, if we have time, Smith. In my day at Smith, the one who did some publishing was Vera Brown in Latin American history. She did do some publishing. Miss Scott never did any, and thus no one would ever think of inviting, dear and sweet a person as she was, think of inviting her to a university. Leona Gable was a good historian and did publish something in the Smith College Studies, but again, it would not have been of the nature that would have attracted a university tour. Yeah. They were good historians, but in terms of publishing, I think Vera Brown, was she there when you were there?
No.
Mrs. Holmes, who later
Holmes
married.
Holmes was, yes.
I don't know.
Gabler was there.
Yeah. She just died, I noticed in the alumni bulletin.
Oh.
So that there were, and at Mount Holyoke there were two publishing women, Nielsen and Putnam, both of whom published very much, and any university might have well in English history. They're both English constitutional. Any university might have looked to them. Though I don't, in my time at Smith, I don't think the women, except Vera Brown, were enough known in the profession in terms of what they'd written.
Okay, that's fair. Jean
was extremely good. She was.
She was the sort of person I was thinking about.
Oh, she was very good, and I think in a university environment, she would have done more publishing than she did.
Mm.
At Smith, the emphasis was, of course, on teaching. She was a very conscientious and devoted teacher, and she did do some publishing. I think in the university, if she had got launched in the university in the beginning, she would have been heard from to a much greater extent than she was. But she was certainly a good historian.
But weren't there women, graduate students at Harvard and Radcliffe who would have...
Not many.
You mean, in other words, you're
not
saying that Saxe's judgment is true. I
hate to admit it, but when we, when Beale and I, who were both very strong, to get a woman here, we made a very conscientious effort to find women whose records seemed to at least roughly match, or at least approximate, those of the men in terms of publication, because we felt that in the university, where anyone would normally be teaching graduate students, that the reputation of the department depended on how they were known outside and how would they be known if they didn't publish. And we did find again and again women who were good teachers, obviously, and who would have contributed a lot in teaching, and I think that's important. I think sometimes one of the weaknesses of this institution is that I'm not sure that the teaching is as good as it is at the good undergraduate institutions. My guess is, well, I don't know, but that I did a better job of teaching it at Smith than I did here. It was expected of you, and the competition was in reputation for being a good teacher. This was what you competed for at Smith, not your publications. And I think I did better teaching. I think I threw myself into it, and this is what I was doing. But it is true, with the one exception, when we did find somebody, and then I wrote down to the little teachers' college in Missouri, and they said she's hard to get along with.
Yeah, you told that story.
Well, she's at Indiana, and she's published a good deal. She would have been a good appointment.
But it
was true that when I think Beale and I were the two who most wanted to have a woman here, quite apart from the Florence Robinson thing, we felt that in a coeducational university, it was ridiculous, to have a department with no women. And the English department had some of their strongest people, were people like Ruth Wallerstein, who was extremely good. But it is true that was the record. But as I say, I don't think publication is the only thing to be.
Well, it is obviously important.
As I think, good teaching, if you can establish criteria for it, and there's a consensus, as there was often at Smith, that some were very outstanding teachers. The students' judgment, after all, they were the ones who were being taught, and their judgment did count for something.
Mm.
And when they said, Esther Dunn gives stunning lectures, you had to think, she probably did.
Yeah. Well, we have been talking a little bit about the American Caucus. Were you around at the time of the issue over the MA, the dropping of the MA degree?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was a very bitter conflict, apparently. I'm told that Jensen refused to go to caucus meetings. I don't know for how long after that decision was made, because he opposed it. Dave Cronin opposed it.
Dropping it?
The MA, yes. The reason for doing so, as I understand it, was that there were so many MA candidates and that they were confusing the seminars, that there were so many people in the seminars and you didn't know what level to teach at because you had mixtures. What was your own
My feeling was that if you had enough students, as I did, the thing to do is to separate them. And I had always a seminar for master's candidates and another one for those who were working for a PhD. And so I recognized the problem for those who didn't have that many students, that it would be very difficult. I felt that the master's degree had the one value and enough to warrant keeping it, and that was you could tell from a master's essay, you could tell whether the person was likely to be able to do a PhD dissertation or not. Mm. And without something of that scope, it would be hard to say. They might talk in a very brilliant way and yet And yet when it came to writing, they might not be able to pull it off. And I thought we didn't have that at Harvard. And the master's degree at Harvard was nothing at all. You took three or four courses, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And got a passing grade, and you got a master's degree. And I thought that was one of the weaknesses. So I felt that it was important to have it. And some of the master's essays were quite good. I just, for my own curiosity, tried to make a list of what my master's students wrote about, because I'd forgotten, and I was trying to find out what they wrote about. You know, I didn't keep any records. And they wrote on some very interesting topics, and looking back on them, some of those were quite interesting essays. But on the teaching, I felt that, in my own case, I always had two seminars, or ran it in two sections, if it was one. Mm-hmm. Might come together for a few meetings, but then I ran it as two. So I felt there was a justification in keeping it. Now, I can't remember the bitterness of this conflict.
You can't?
No. I know I favored keeping
Apparently,
it.
Apparently, again, Phil Curtin...
Who was against it?
Well, Jensen was very strongly against dropping it.
Yes.
And I know Dave Cronin was.
Yes, I'm sure I was opposed to dropping it.
Phil Curtin was one of those who favored dropping it. He and somebody else felt that a seminar paper would give adequate indication of whether the person was capable of doing a PhD. And let's see.
Well, I'm sure Heseltine was in favor of it, wasn't he? I would have thought so.
Oh yeah, here it is. It was Al Bogue who talked about this.
Yes,
One of the issues was that graduate students would always tend to go to choose as their advisor, as their PhD professor, the person into whose seminar they first went. Therefore, the MA was a way of getting graduate students for yourself. That was one of the issues. Do you?
I remember that was discussed. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and he cites Stan Katz as an example of this. Whether that's true, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And he said when it came to a vote, Cronin and Jensen and perhaps Bob Nesbitt voted against the revision.
I wonder what date was that?
Well, he says the mid-60s. He says the American caucus was deeply divided over this proposal to revise the graduate program.
I was still teaching, but I remember there had always been some discussion about it, but I can't remember how divided the American caucus was. I wonder if I didn't go to it. It would seem to me that I would have gone to it if, as long as I was teaching. I tried to be conscientious about things. And I know that after long discussions and experience, I felt that there was a justification for it, that we did learn. And that in fairness to the students, if a student in a master's essay and in the oral gave indication of really being weaker than we'd thought and not likely to be a successful teacher or have difficulty. In fairness to them, it was very good to tell them we can't definitely say you can't come back, but we don't advise it. And we did that in some cases. And I thought that was fair to the students rather than having them string along and then finally come up against a great disappointment. But this I was asked Phil Al about that sometime because I can't remember.
I hope he won't think I'm revealing secrets.
I better not.
You know, he said this to me.
But if he said that, then it must. I'm sure it's true.
You could just ask him what.
I'm sure if he said it, but I can't remember going to these caucuses where it was where there was much conflict. I can't remember doing it.
Maybe the conflict went on behind the scenes. Sure.
Now, could it have been? I was away in 1964 and 5.
Well, that would be mid-60s.
And it might have been the Cab Door
that
when I was away.
Wasn't it? Wiley was 64 to 66, mm-hmm. was chairman.
Yes. Well, it might have come then because I just don't remember this. I do remember that, well, we'd always discussed this. It wasn't just something new at that time. Mm-hmm. It had been discussed for a long time. And at first I was unfamiliar. Well, Columbia had it, and so far as I had an experience at Columbia, I thought it was better than the Harvard system, where mm-hmm. The master's degree was simply a degree for courses, including one seminar.
Yeah, Cornell had it. I've always been grateful. I wrote a master's thesis, and I've always been glad because it was something that was very different from any term paper.
Yes, it's quite different, but there's more to it.
Well, that's the other subject that I wanted to talk to you about was your own teaching, your own policy on graduate students. I know you were thought to have a great many graduate students.
Too many,
yes.
Yeah.
And that you felt that you ought to take anybody who applied.
Yes, and this was a great mistake. Were it to be all done over again, and I knew what I know, I would have restricted the numbers to a much greater extent than I did.
Why didn't you at the time?
Why didn't I? Well, I suppose there are several reasons. One, I suppose it was flattering to know that people wanted to come here and work with you. One has an ego.
Oh,
and
dear. Go ahead.
And I think another reason was that I felt until you had given somebody a chance, it was very difficult to prejudge them. And I think it was my generally democratic impulse to say, well, give everybody a chance. But I think often after I'd given them a chance, I should have said, look, I really think you shouldn't go on. And sometimes I didn't do that.
You didn't say that.
And I sometimes didn't do it. I did sometimes, but I didn't always. And I think I made a mistake.
You were afraid of hurting
their feelings. Very much afraid of hurting their feelings. I didn't want to. I thought, well, maybe this person can make it. Oh. And maybe they should be given a chance. But this was one of my weaknesses.
Did anybody ever criticize you for it?
I don't know. They probably did, but I don't think they did directly. But they probably did indirectly.
They might have hinted.
Oh, I would think so. Well, I would have been very glad if somebody had said, look, you know, have you really considered this enough? Mm. But nobody did. Because while I naturally, like everyone, is sensitive to criticism, I think I'm also someone who can listen to criticism and it may hurt me, but I think I will recognize the validity of much of criticism that has been made of me, and I think that was it. Would have been better to have had fewer students and given them more than I was able to give them.
Well, that was the other question: is how you handled your manage these things.
I did try to do everything I could. I certainly worked extremely hard, and I tried not to let my own research take precedence. I thought of my students as my main and first job, but I did have my hands in a lot of other things. I was, you know, on the Social Science Research Council. I was on the American Council of Learner Societies. I was on a lot of different things. I was president of our two leading associations, many committees. And I did have, and I was invited to give a great many lectures in places, and it was always flattering to be invited to a part of the country you've never been in. But even so, I tried to, I know on several occasions I turned down invitations to go somewhere on the score, including Harvard, on the score for a visiting arrangement. I turned down on the score that it would be unfair to my graduate students, that they really needed me and I needed to be on the ground to help them. And other invitations that would have been normally very attractive for a year or two. So I was conscientious enough about them, but I think probably I expected more from them than they were able to deliver, and perhaps should have seen in some cases sooner than I did that they weren't really up to what I had expected.
What would happen on the in the orals when there were other people there? Did
yes.
they have trouble? Would some of them say, "Well, this student isn't good enough," or did you?
I can't remember about that. There may, if there were, I think probably it was partly justified. I don't know. I can't remember.
But it didn't happen. I'm just, you know,
yes,
the
I can't remember specific instances where it happened.
The problem with the people like John, who sometimes have to take students from other countries, knows that they're not good enough quality, is painfully finally decides to take them, and then constantly is faced with the fact that they're not really up to snuff and how to handle it. And I just wonder, you must have had this. Yes. You say that you knew some of your students weren't really good. And yet they did get through. They got their
some of them did. A lot of them didn't.
Oh.
There were a lot of casualties. A lot of them didn't.
Oh, I see.
A lot of them didn't.
Would they drop out or were they something?
They were just dropped out, and either they decided or I told them. I said, well, I don't think there's any use. I don't think you're going to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think were it to do all over again, I would have taken fewer students and restricted the numbers. Mm-hmm. It was always because if you take a student, as Carstensen once said, if you take a student, you have a lifelong obligation to them. I still, after all of these years, am occasionally asked to write letters supporting a grant that a student maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Was in one of my classes. I barely remember. Sometimes I say, I'd like to, but I can't do it. Sometimes I say, my days are broken. But in general, I try to do the best I can to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always the problem of getting a job.
I was going to ask you if you were
and here, I think, was probably the greatest source of competition in the American History Group. That is, each of us, if a job came up, each of us would want to get our student if it were a good one.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it was lessened by the fact that often there would be, except in small colleges, there would be an indication of what field was desired. And when that was clearly specified, then I think, you know, we respected that.
Yeah.
We, obviously so-and-so would have to fit in that.
Yeah. But if it wasn't specified,
then we might, you know, plug for our own students.
What would happen then?
I don't remember.
Did you telephone the department chairman, each of you, and say, I mean, in the college that wants the student?
No, I never did that.
Candidate's
no,
the best?
No, I never did that, no.
Well, how did you push a student?
I mean, I just, insofar as I could argue with my colleagues, then if somebody really seemed to have a stronger case or in awareness, I was okay.
But it isn't you people who decide; it's the university who's hiring that decides.
Yes.
But in what?
But we had to decide which ones we were going to push for an opening.
It came as a department recommendation rather than as a personal recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes when it came as a personal recommendation, then there was no question about it. But often it didn't.
Which means the department says we think that among our American history students, this is the best one for the job.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see. That could
create some trouble.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen very often because I think in general...
Well, you got out before it really got bad.
Yes, I got out before the pinch really came.
Mm.
But there, and you see, you not only... I guess the main competition was with colleagues in other graduate schools elsewhere who also had students who they were pushing. And at meetings, you would run into this. The person that you were trying to get the job for, you would find one of your friends in another graduate school also trying to get one of his people into it. But there were never any serious problems. It was just awkward.
Yeah,
it was just an awkward situation. And you'd laugh it off and say, "Well, the best man will win," something like that.
How long did you go on teaching undergraduates?
Oh, well, I taught undergraduates. I can't remember when I first came here. It was mostly undergraduates because it was wartime and we had very few graduate students. And then after the war, we were flooded with GIs, and I remember I had a seminar where I think there were about 30 people in it, which was ridiculous. I think I tried to break it up into two, but it counted as one.
That was a seminar. So that was graduate.
Yes, and I had very large undergraduate classes after when the veterans came back. I can't remember how long, but I liked undergraduate teaching. And then I think after a while, I taught chiefly graduate students and didn't have any undergraduates for some years. Mm-hmm. And then I decided, well, I'm missing the undergraduate students. Mm-hmm. And I asked the department to give the introductory, if they had several sections, and I said, I'd like to have one of those sections and try my hand at it. I never actually ever taught it in all my career. I never taught one. And I did for a couple of years, and I enjoyed it very much. And then I had, the last two or three years, I had several small so-called undergraduate seminars of 15 students. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed them very much. So I did do a good deal of I felt... My general feeling was that the undergraduates here probably didn't get as good instruction often as they might in a different kind of an institution. Not that our TAs in the big lecture courses were incompetent. Some of them were really very good, but some of them weren't. I visited all of my TAs, their classes. I was interested in not only what they were doing, but what they were giving to the undergraduates, because after I had a responsibility for them, they were in a big lecture course, and I was giving the course. I was always interested in undergraduates, and I felt that the university should pay more attention to undergraduates, and Harrington agreed with this in theory, at least. I don't know whether he did very much to improve it. We obviously couldn't have we couldn't have a tutorial system. We couldn't afford anything like that, and it was a question of what we could do to improve undergraduate teaching. But when Leon Epstein was dean, he took this very seriously, that we should do more to him, that he wanted in his deanship. And he set up a committee of members of the faculty who had the reputation of being good undergraduate teachers and who were also research people, and students. This was a joint thing. Mm. And we had discussion for a year on how we could improve. This was in Epstein's deanship. But I have the feeling in general that...
nothing came of it?
Not, I think, a great deal. And I don't know really what can come of it. I'm not sure what can come of it. But I feel this is where I would like to see the university strengthen in its undergraduate teaching. Because I think if you're going to have 30,000 students, or how many it is, 40,000, many of them haven't, or have to be undergraduates, and I think that they deserve the best that the institution can give them. And I always felt perhaps we weren't doing as much in our emphasis on research and graduate training.
I guess it was Heseltine who's more quoted as saying that a survey course shouldn't be entrusted to a young professor.
Yes, yes. And he was right. I agreed with him. I thought that was very, very sound. Mm-hmm. That was very sound.
Well,
I did insist in undergraduate teaching on something which wasn't generally done, on papers, on term papers. And I know that a great many who were teaching undergraduate history courses didn't ask the undergraduates to write a paper, but I had the feeling that a student missed something if in a history course, if he just had some textbook and some books of reading and a couple of paper writes, that he needed to have the experience of being in the library, and the only way you could ensure that was to have a paper. And that needed a certain amount of supervision. And then I also recognized that there were these commercial outfits that wrote papers, so this posed a problem. But I did always require some kind of a written paper that would require them to get into the library. And that was minimal, but at least it seemed to me something. that I hated to think of my own undergraduate days. Had my history teaching been such that I never had to go to Widener Library. So I did think that the writing of papers.
Excuse me, you said it had been, or are you saying if it had been?
Oh no, if it had been,
yes,
but we had
yes,
the Lamotte wasn't formed then. There was just Widener. Mm-hmm. We had to spend hours doing history reading as undergraduates in the library. So I felt that students who were taking courses here in history and not writing a paper were missing a great deal of what history instruction ought to give them. I did try to do it. Not too successfully, but I made the effort.
I'll just look through what we said and see if there was anything you brought up. But when we had lunch the other day, you didn't deal much with TAs, really.
Yes, quite a lot. But, of course, in those days, TAs weren't organized and were often so glad to get some kind of financial support that they welcomed a chance to get a TA. And I took it quite seriously because I thought it was an apprenticeship for them and they ought to be learning something about teaching. And I always, as I say, visited their classes.
How did you choose them?
Well, I always had in mind, how would they perform in a classroom? And I did have that in mind. Sometimes I made mistakes. Some of them weren't particularly good when I visited them. But others were extremely good. And this enabled me, if they went on and got a PhD and were in the job market, to say something about. I did make some notes on them as I went along, say something about my impression of them as teachers in STAs. But I wasn't always successful in getting probably the best ones. Sometimes I had them who were quite lifeless and didn't seem to, care whether they were teaching or not. Not many cases, but a few. And this is very tragic because the undergraduates were obviously being cheated.
Did you do research at night, on weekends, or did you wait till you had a research leave?
Except for the first two or three summers, I never taught summer school.
So you did it during the summer.
So our summers were almost completely devoted to it. And I did have, after the Turner professor was established, I did less teaching. I had more time, theoretically at least, fewer class hours. And I worked very hard. I did have some research leaves, I remember. Both because of the Turner professorship and also when we got our grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, which was given really to be in the Ford Foundation, I used some of that to free myself from all teaching and work on philanthropy or whatever it was the grant was for.
Did you do this at the office usually, at your office?
No.
At the library?
At the library. No, I had a study in the university library, and sometimes in the historical. At that time, in the historical side, I didn't have enough studies, so I didn't have one there very much. But I worked there, and I worked at home too. But I worked.
When would you do it? During just hours of any day, or did you devote a particular day or a particular afternoon?
Well, days that I weren't teaching, that I didn't. I tried to have my office hours and so forth on the days that I taught.
Yeah.
So I would have some days.
A couple of days. Yes. So you would do research.
Yeah, I would do research and not appear at my office at all. I'd just go to my study and stay there. I think I got a very good deal done in the summers by not being around here. We were in New Hampshire, And I had a lot of notes.
Yes,
and I had a great many notes with me, and I also used the excellent Dartmouth Library. I had a study there. Actually, I did the writing, most of it, in a study in the Dartmouth College Library. I think those that hadn't read, if I'd been here on the ground in the summertime, I would have been involved in a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be around and not be. And I think it was that I just got away in the summertime, went mm-hmm. someplace else.
So you had plenty of push to get your writing done.
Yes.
You really
mm-hmm.
wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Didn't have to, no blocks.
No. No. And everyone in the administration and everyone in the department was really very, all the chairmen were very cooperative about this. There was never, was always a desire to have me take advantage of anything that came along mm. to research. So it was a nice spirit.
Mm.
And I think it generally prevailed. I don't think I was exceptional in it.
Well, do you have anything else you want to say?
No, I think that I suppose it's impossible to tell everything, but I think I've told the things that stand out in my memory as important things as I experience them. What some future historian writing on the history of the department might make of all of this, I don't know. But I've tried to give as clear and as objective an account as my failing memory and the fact that we're all subject to some conscious or unconscious bias has permitted.
Oh, yes, that's well known.
So I suppose
in the discipline of history that the issues will be the extent to which history began to include other disciplines and spread from the
right.
European and American
right.
emphasis to the third world. And
right.
And who were the influential people?
Yes. Well, I will claim some influence in that.
Yes, I...
Because I thought it was very important. And the European historians, when I came here, were not really minded that way
yeah.
at all. They argued that it was better to do a few things and do them well than to try to spread out into mm-hmm. these new things. And I do take a little credit with others.
Yeah.
With others. And there were people from other departments who were developing programs, and they needed an historian that, you know, would fit into the programs that other departments were developing. So
mm-hmm.
that had a great deal to do with it, as well as anything that those of us in the department could do to push it ahead.
Yes, actually, you talked about that. Someone and Harrington did in his interview, I guess.
Right.
Well, thank you. Oh, did you want to add something?
No. I thank you very much.